This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Hard Thing About Hard Things. Building a business when there are no easy answers by Ben Horowitz. Read by Kevin Kennerly. This is for Felicia, Sophia, Mariah, and the Boucher, mi familia, for putting up with me when I was learning all of this. 100% of my portion of the proceeds of this book will go to help women in developing countries gain basic civil rights via the American Jewish World Service. They truly face the hard things. Introduction. This the real world, homie. School finished. They done stole your dreams. You don't know who did it. Kanye West. Gorgeous. Every time I read a management or self-help book, I find myself saying, that's fine, but that wasn't really the hard thing about the situation. The hard thing isn't setting a big, hairy, audacious goal. The hard thing is laying people off when you miss the big goal. The hard thing isn't hiring great people. The hard thing is when those great people develop a sense of entitlement and start demanding unreasonable things. The hard thing isn't setting up an organizational chart. The hard thing is getting people to communicate within the organization that you just designed. The hard thing isn't dreaming big. The hard thing is waking up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat when the dream turns into a nightmare. The problem with these books is that they attempt to provide a recipe for challenges that have no recipes. There's no recipe for really complicated, dynamic situations. There's no recipe for building a high-tech company. There's no recipe for leading a group of people out of trouble. There's no recipe for making a series of hit songs. There's no recipe for playing NFL quarterback. There's no recipe for running for president. And there's no recipe for motivating teams when your business has turned to crap. That's the hard thing about hard things. There is no formula for dealing with them. Nonetheless, there are many bits of advice and experience that can help with the hard things. I do not attempt to present a formula in this book. Instead, I present my story and the difficulties that I have faced. As an entrepreneur, a CEO, and now as a venture capitalist, I still find these lessons useful, especially as I work with a new generation of founder CEOs. Building a company inevitably leads to tough times. I've been there. I've done that. Circumstances may differ, but the deeper patterns and the lessons keep resonating. For the past several years, I've encapsulated these lessons in a series of blog posts that have been read by millions of people. Many of those have reached out to me wanting to know the backstory to the lessons. This book tells that backstory for the first time and includes the related lessons from the blog. I've also been inspired by many friends, advisors, and family members who've helped me throughout my career, and also by hip-hop rap music. Because hip-hop artists aspire to be both great and successful and see themselves as entrepreneurs, many of the themes, competing, making money, being misunderstood, provide insight into the hard things. I share my experiences in the hope of providing clues and inspiration for others who find themselves in the struggle to build something out of nothing. Chapter 1. From Communist to Venture Capitalist. This here's all about my wife, my kids, the life that I lived through the night. I was his. It was right. But I did my ups and downs, my slips, my falls, my trials and tribulations, my heart, my balls. DMX. Who we be. The other day I threw a big barbecue at my house and invited 100 of my closest friends. These types of gatherings aren't unusual. My brother-in-law Carthew and I have been barbecuing for years, and my skills have earned me the nickname from my African-American friends, the Jackie Robinson of barbecue. I crossed the color line. At this particular barbecue, the conversation turned to the great rapper Nas. My friend Tristan Walker, a young African-American entrepreneur, commented proudly that Nas was from his home project, Queensbridge, New York. one of the largest public housing projects in the United States. My 73-year-old Jewish father interjected, "I've been to Queensbridge." Convinced that there was no way that my old white father had been to Queensbridge, Tristan said, "You must mean Queens. Queensbridge is actually a housing project in an extremely rough neighborhood." My father insisted, "No, it was Queensbridge." I pointed out to Tristan that my father grew up in Queens, so he couldn't possibly be confused. Then I asked, "Dad, what were you doing in Queensbridge?" He replied, "I was passing out communist literature when I was 11 years old. I remember it well, because my mother got very upset that the Communist Party sent me into the projects. She thought it was too dangerous for a little kid." My grandparents were actually card-carrying communists. As an active member of the Communist Party, my grandfather, Phil Horowitz, lost his job as a schoolteacher during the McCarthy era. My father was a red diaper baby and grew up indoctrinated in the philosophy of the left. In 1968, he moved our family west to Berkeley, California, and became editor of the famed New Left magazine, Ramparts. As a result, I grew up in the city, affectionately known by its inhabitants as the People's Republic of Berkeley. As a young child, I was incredibly shy and terrified of adults. When my mother dropped me off at nursery school for the first time, I began to cry. The teacher told my mother to just leave, while reassuring her that crying was common among nursery school children. But when Alyssa Horowitz returned 3 hours later, she found me soaking wet and still crying. The teacher explained that I hadn't stopped, and now my clothes were drenched as a result. I got kicked out of nursery school that day. If my mother hadn't been the most patient person in the world, I might never have gone to school. When everybody around her recommended psychiatric treatment, she was patient, willing to wait until I got comfortable with the world, no matter how long it took. When I was 5 years old, we moved from a one-bedroom house on Glen Avenue, which had become far too small for a six-person family, to a larger one on Bonita Avenue. Bonita was middle-class Berkeley, which means something a bit different from what one finds in most middle-class neighborhoods. The block was a collection of hippies, crazy people, lower-class people working hard to move up, and upper-class people taking enough drugs to move down. One day, one of my older brother Jonathan's friends, Roger, not his real name, was over at our house. Roger pointed to an African-American kid down the block who was riding in a red wagon. Roger dared me, "Go down the street, tell that kid to give you his wagon, and if he says anything, spit in his face and call him a nigger." A few things require clarification here. First, we were in Berkeley, so that was not common language. In fact, I'd never heard the word nigger before and didn't know what it meant, though I guessed it wasn't a compliment. Second, Roger wasn't racist, and he wasn't raised in a bad home. His father was a Berkeley professor, and both his parents were some of the nicest people in the world, but we later found out that Roger suffered from schizophrenia, and his dark side wanted to see a fight. Roger's command put me in a difficult situation. I was terrified of Roger. I thought that he would surely give me a severe beating if I didn't follow his instructions. On the other hand, I was terrified of asking for the wagon. Hell, I was terrified of everything. I was much too scared of Roger to stay where I was, so I began walking down the block toward the other kid. The distance was probably 30 yards, but it felt like 30 miles. When I finally got there, I could barely move. I did not know what to say, so I just opened my mouth and started talking. "Can I ride in your wagon?" is what came out. Joel Clark Jr. said, "Sure." When I turned to see what Roger would do, he was gone. Apparently his light side had taken over and he'd moved on to something else. Joel and I went on to play all day that day, and we've been best friends ever since. 18 years later, he would be the best man at my wedding. Until now, I've never told that story to anyone, but it shaped my life. It taught me that being scared didn't mean I was gutless. What I did mattered and would determine whether I would be a hero or a coward. I've often thought back on that day, realizing that if I'd done what Roger told me to do, I would never have met my best friend. That experience also taught me not to judge things by their surfaces. Until you make the effort to get to know someone or something, you don't know anything. There are no shortcuts to knowledge, especially knowledge gained from personal experience. Following conventional wisdom and relying on shortcuts can be worse than knowing nothing at all. Turn your shit in. Over the years, I worked hard to avoid being influenced by first impressions and blindly adhering to convention. Growing up in Berkeley as an excellent student in a town that frowned upon football as being too militaristic, I wasn't expected to join the Berkeley High School football team. But that's what I did. This was a big step for me. I had not played in any of the Pee Wee football leagues, so it was my first exposure to the sport. Nonetheless, those earlier lessons in dealing with fear helped me tremendously. In high school football, being able to handle fear is 75% of the game. I will never forget the first team meeting with head coach Chico Mendoza. Coach Mendoza was a tough old guy who had played college football at Texas Christian University, home of the mighty Horned Frogs. Coach Mendoza began his opening speech. "Some of you guys will come out here, and you just won't be serious. You'll get here and start shooting the shit, talking shit, bullshitting, not doing shit, and just want to look good in your football shit. If you do that, then you know what? Turn your shit in." He went on to elaborate on what was unacceptable. "Come late to practice? Turn your shit in. Don't want to hit? Turn your shit in. Walk on the grass? Turn your shit in. Call me Chico? Turn your shit in." It was the most intense, hilarious, poetic speech I'd ever heard. I loved it. I couldn't wait to get home and tell my mother. She was horrified, but I still loved it. In retrospect, it was my first lesson in leadership. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell says that leadership is the ability to get someone to follow you, even if only out of curiosity. I was certainly curious to see what Coach Mendoza would say next. I was the only kid on the football team who was also on the highest academic track in math, so my teammates and I didn't see each other in many classes. As a result, I ended up moving in multiple social circles and hanging out with kids with very different outlooks on the world. It amazed me how a diverse perspective utterly changed the meaning of every significant event in the world. For instance, when Run-DMC's Hard Times album came out, with its relentless bass drum, it sent an earthquake through the football team, but not even a ripple through my calculus class. Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative was considered an outrage among young scientists due to its questionable technical foundation, but those aspects went unnoticed at football practice. Looking at the world through such different prisms helped me separate facts from perception. This ability would serve me incredibly well later when I became an entrepreneur and CEO. In particularly dire circumstances, when the facts seemed to dictate a certain outcome, I learned to look for alternative narratives and explanations coming from radically different perspectives to inform my outlook. The simple existence of an alternate, plausible scenario is often all that's needed to keep hope alive among a worried workforce. Blind date. In the summer of 1986, I had finished my sophomore year of college at Columbia University, and I was staying with my father, who was now living in Los Angeles. I had been set up on a blind date by my friend and high school football teammate, Claude Shaw. Claude and I got ready for the double date with his girlfriend, Jackie Williams, and my date, Felicia Wiley, by preparing an elaborate dinner. We meticulously planned and cooked all day and had the entire meal, including four perfectly presented T-bone steaks, ready at 7 p.m., date time. But there were no dates. An hour passed, but we didn't get too worked up. Jackie was known for her tardiness, so no worries. Then 2 hours passed, and Claude called for a status check. I listened in shock as I looked over the now cold gourmet meal that we'd prepared. My date, Felicia, had decided that she was too tired to show up for the date. Wow, how obnoxious. I told Claude to hand me the phone. I introduced myself. "Hi, this is Ben, your blind date." Felicia: "I am sorry, but I'm tired and it is late." Me: "Well, it is late, because you are late." Felicia: "I know, but I'm just too tired to come over." At this point, I decided to appeal to her sense of empathy. Me: "Well, I understand your predicament, but the time to communicate this message would have been before we spent all day cooking dinner." At this point, anything short of getting into your car and driving here immediately would be rude and leave a permanently poor impression. If she was totally self-centered, as she appeared to be, my plea would have no effect, and I would be better off missing the date. On the other hand, if she didn't want to go out like that, then there might be something there. Felicia: okay, I'll come over. 90 minutes later, she arrived, wearing white shorts and looking as pretty as can be. In all my focus and anticipation about the date, I had completely forgotten about the fist fight I'd been in the day before. During a pickup basketball game in the San Fernando Valley, a 6'2" crew-cut sporting, camouflage pants-wearing, fraternity boy-looking player threw the ball at my brother. Jonathan was a musician, had long hair, and probably weighed about 155 pounds at the time. On the other hand, I was used to football and fighting, and was ready for action. I judged the situation on my first impression, and I rushed the frat boy. A scuffle ensued. I landed some good punches, but caught a right hook under my left eye, leaving a bit of a mark. It's possible that my target player was simply mad about a hard foul rather than trying to bully my brother, but that's the price of not taking the time to understand. I will never know. Whatever the case, when I opened the door to greet our dates, Felicia's award-winning green eyes immediately fixed on the welt under my eye. Her first impression, told to me years later, this guy's a thug. Coming here was a big mistake. Fortunately, neither of us relied on our first impressions. We have been happily married for nearly 25 years and have 3 wonderful children. Silicon Valley. During one summer in college, I got a job as an engineer at a company called Silicon Graphics, SGI. The experience blew my mind. The company invented modern computer graphics and powered a whole new class set of applications ranging from the movie Terminator 2 to amazing flight simulators. Everybody there was so smart. The things they built were so cool. I wanted to work for Silicon Graphics for the rest of my life. After graduating from college and graduate school in computer science, I went back to work for SGI. Being there was a dream come true, and I loved it. After my first year at SGI, I met a former head of marketing for the company, Rosalie Buonoro, who had a new startup. Rosalie had heard about me from her daughter, who also worked with me at SGI. Rosalie recruited me hard. Eventually, she got me, and I went to work for her at NetLabs. Joining NetLabs turned out to be a horrible decision for me. The company was run by Andre Swager, a former Hewlett-Packard executive, and more important, Rosalie's husband. Andre and Rosalie had been brought in by the venture capitalists as the professional management team. Unfortunately, they understood very little about the products or the technology, and they sent the company off in one crazy direction after the next. This was the first time that I started to understand the importance of founders running their companies. To make matters more complicated, my second daughter, Mariah, had been diagnosed with autism, which made working at a startup a terrible burden for our family, as I needed to spend more time at home. One very hot day, my father came over for a visit. We could not afford air conditioning, and all 3 children were crying as my father and I sat there sweating in the 105-degree heat. My father turned to me and said, "Son, do you know what's cheap?" Since I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about, I replied, "No, what?" "Flowers. Flowers are really cheap. But do you know what's expensive?" he asked. Again I replied, "No, what?" He said, "Divorce." Something about that joke, which was not really a joke, made me realize that I had run out of time. Up until that point, I had not really made any serious choices. I felt like I had unlimited bandwidth and could do everything in life that I wanted to do simultaneously. But his joke made it suddenly clear that by continuing on the course I was on, I might lose my family. By doing everything, I would fail at the most important thing. It was the first time that I forced myself to look at the world through priorities that were not purely my own. I thought that I could pursue my career, all my interests, and build my family. More important, I always thought about myself first. When you are part of a family or part of a group, that kind of thinking can get you into trouble. And I was in deep trouble. In my mind, I was confident that I was a good person, and not selfish, but my actions said otherwise. I had to stop being a boy and become a man. I had to put first things first. I had to consider the people who I cared about most before considering myself. I decided to quit NetLabs the next day. I found a job at Lotus Development that would allow me to get my home life straightened out. I stopped thinking about myself and focused on what was best for my family. I started being the person that I wanted to be. Netscape. One day, while working at Lotus, one of my coworkers showed me a new product called Mosaic, which was developed by some students at the University of Illinois. Mosaic was essentially a graphical interface to the Internet, a technology formerly only used by scientists and researchers. It amazed me. It was so obviously the future, and I was so obviously wasting my time working on anything but the Internet. Several months later, I read about a company called Netscape, which had been co-founded by former Silicon Graphics founder Jim Clark and Mosaic inventor Mark Andreessen. I instantly decided that I should interview for a job there. I called a friend who worked at Netscape and asked if he could get me an interview with the company. He obliged, and I was on my way. During the first interviews, I met everyone on the product management team. I thought the meetings went well, but when I arrived home that evening, Felicia was in tears. The Netscape recruiter had called me to give me some tips, and Felicia had answered. This was before the days of pervasive cell phones. The recruiter informed her that it would be unlikely I'd get the job, because the group was looking for candidates with Stanford or Harvard MBAs. Felicia suggested that maybe I could go back to school. Given that we had three children, she knew this was unrealistic. Hence the tears. I explained that recruiters were not hiring managers, and that they might consider me despite my lack of proper business schooling. The next day, the hiring manager called back to let me know that they wanted me to interview with co-founder and chief technical officer Mark Andreessen. He was 22 years old at the time. In retrospect, it's easy to think both the web browser and the Internet were inevitable. But without Mark's work, it is likely that we would be living in a very different world. At the time, most people believed only scientists and researchers would use the Internet. The Internet was thought to be too arcane, insecure, and slow to meet real business needs. Even after the introduction of Mosaic, the world's first browser, almost nobody thought the Internet would be significant beyond the scientific community, least of all the most important technology industry leaders who were busy building proprietary alternatives. The overwhelming favorites to dominate the race to become the so-called information superhighway were competing proprietary technologies from industry powerhouses such as Oracle and Microsoft. Their stories captured the imagination of the business press. This was not so illogical, since most companies didn't even run TCP/IP, the software foundation for the Internet. They ran proprietary networking protocols such as AppleTalk, NetBIOS, and SNA. As late as November 1995, Bill Gates wrote a book titled The Road Ahead, in which he predicted that the information superhighway, a network connecting all businesses and consumers in a world of frictionless commerce, would be the logical successor to the Internet and would rule the future. Gates later went back and changed references from the information superhighway to the Internet, but that was not his original vision. The implications of this proprietary vision were not good for business or for consumers. In the minds of visionaries like Bill Gates and Larry Ellison, the corporations that owned the information superhighway would tax every transaction by charging a vigorish, as Microsoft's then chief technology officer Nathan Myhrvold referred to it. It's difficult to overstate the momentum that the proprietary information superhighway carried. After Mosaic, even Mark and his co-founder Jim Clark originally planned a business for video distribution to run on top of the proprietary information superhighway, not the Internet. It wasn't until deep into the planning process that they decided that by improving the browser to make it secure, more functional, and easier to use, they could make the Internet the network of the future. And that became the mission of Netscape, a mission that they would gloriously accomplish. Interviewing with Mark was like no other job interview I'd ever had. Gone were questions about my resume, my career progression, and my work habits. He replaced them with a dizzying inquiry into the history of email, collaboration software, and what the future might hold. I was an expert in the topic, because I'd spent the last several years working on the leading products in the category. But I was shocked by how much a 22-year-old kid knew about the history of the computer business. I've met many really smart young people in my career, but never a young technology historian. Mark's intellect and instincts took me aback. But beyond Mark's historical knowledge, his insights about technologies such as replication were incisive and on point. After the interview, I phoned my brother and told him that I'd just interviewed with Mark Andreessen, and I thought that he might be the smartest person I'd ever met. A week later, I got the job. I was thrilled. I didn't really care what the offer was. I knew that Mark and Netscape would change the world, and I wanted to be part of it. I could not wait to get started. Once at Netscape, I was put in charge of their enterprise web server product line. The line consisted of two products, the regular web server, which listed for $1,200, and the secure web server, a web server that included the then brand new security protocol invented by Netscape called SSL, Secure Sockets Layer, for $5,000. At the time that I joined, we had two engineers working on the web servers, Rob McCool, who had invented the NCSA web server, and his twin brother, Mike McCool. By the time Netscape went public in August 1995, we had grown the web server team to about 9 engineers. The Netscape initial public offering, IPO, was both spectacular and historic. The stock initially priced at $14 per share, but a last-minute decision doubled the initial offering to $28 per share. It spiked to $75, nearly a record for a first-day gain, and closed at $58, giving Netscape a market value of nearly $3 billion on the day of the IPO. More than that, the IPO was an earthquake in the business world. As my friend and investment banker Frank Quattrone said at the time, no one wanted to tell their grandchildren that they'd missed out on this one. The deal changed everything. Microsoft had been in business for more than a decade before its IPO. We'd been alive for 16 months. Companies began to get defined as new economy or as old economy. And the new economy was winning. The New York Times called the Netscape IPO world-shaking. But there was a crack in our armor. Microsoft announced that it would be bundling its browser, Internet Explorer, with its upcoming breakthrough operating system release, Windows 95, for free. This posed a huge problem to Netscape, because nearly all of our revenue came from browser sales, and Microsoft controlled more than 90% of operating systems. Our answer to investors? We would make our money on web servers. 2 months later, we got our hands on an early release of Microsoft's upcoming web server, Internet Information Server, IIS. We deconstructed IIS and found that it had every feature that we had, including the security in our high-end product, and was 5 times faster. Uh-oh. I figured that we had about 5 months before Microsoft released IIS to solve the problem, or else we would be toast. In the old economy, product cycles typically took 18 months to complete, so this was an exceptionally short time frame even in the new economy. So I went to see our department head, Mike Homer. With the possible exception of Mark, Mike Homer was the most significant creative force behind Netscape. More important, the worse the situation became, the stronger Mike would get. During particularly brutal competitive attacks, most executives would run from the press. Mike, on the other hand, was always front and center. When Microsoft unveiled its famous embrace and extend strategy, a dramatic pivot to attack Netscape, Mike took every phone call, sometimes even talking to 2 reporters at once with a phone in each hand. He was the ultimate warrior. Mike and I spent the next several months developing a comprehensive answer to Microsoft's threat. If they were going to give our products away, then we were going to offer a dirt-cheap, open alternative to the highly expensive and proprietary Microsoft back-office product line. To do so, we acquired 2 companies, which provided us with a competitive alternative to Microsoft Exchange. We then cut a landmark deal with the database company Informix to provide us unlimited relational database access through the web for $50 a copy, which was literally hundreds of times less than Microsoft charged. Once we assembled the entire package, Mike named it Netscape's sweet spot, as it would be the suite that displaced Microsoft's back office. We lined everything up for a major launch on March 5th, 1996 in New York. Then, just 2 weeks before the launch, Mark, without telling Mike or me, revealed the entire strategy to the publication Computer Reseller News. I was livid. I immediately sent him a short email. To Mark Andreessen, CC Mike Homer, from Ben Horowitz. Subject, launch. I guess we're not going to wait until the 5th to launch the strategy. Ben. Within 15 minutes, I received the following reply. To Ben Horowitz, CC Mike Homer, Jim Barksdale, CEO, Jim Clark, Chairman. From Mark Andreessen. Subject, reply, launch. Apparently you do not understand how serious the situation is. We are getting killed, killed, killed out there. Our current product is radically worse than the competition. We've had nothing to say for months. As a result, we've lost over $3 billion in market capitalization. We are now in danger of losing the entire company, and it's all server product management's fault. Next time, do the fucking interview yourself. Fuck you. Mark. I received this email the same day that Mark appeared barefoot and sitting on a throne on the cover of Time magazine. When I first saw the cover, I felt thrilled. I'd never met anyone in my life who had been on the cover of Time. Then I felt sick. I brought both the magazine and the email home to Felicia to get a second opinion. I was very worried. I was 29 years old, had a wife and 3 children, and needed my job. She looked at the email and the magazine cover and said, "You need to start looking for a job right away." In the end, I didn't get fired. And over the next 2 years, Sweet Spot grew from nothing to a $400 million a year business. More shocking, Mark and I eventually became friends. We've been friends and business partners ever since. People often ask me how we've managed to work effectively across 3 companies over 18 years. Most business relationships either become too tense to tolerate or not tense enough to be productive after a while. Either people challenge each other to the point where they don't like each other, or they become complacent about each other's feedback and no longer benefit from the relationship. With Mark and me, even after 18 years, he upsets me almost every day by finding something wrong in my thinking. And I do the same for him. It works. Starting a company. At the end of 1998, and under immense pressure from Microsoft, which used the full force of its operating system monopoly to subsidize free products in every category in which Netscape competed, we sold the company to America Online, AOL. In the short term, this was a big victory for Microsoft, since it had driven its biggest threat into the arms of a far less threatening competitor. In the long term, however, Netscape inflicted irreparable damage on Microsoft's stronghold on the computing industry. Our work moved developers from Win32 API, Microsoft's proprietary platform, to the Internet. Someone writing new functionality for computers no longer wrote for Microsoft's proprietary platform. Instead, they wrote to the Internet and World Wide Web's standard interfaces. Once Microsoft lost its grip on developers, it became only a matter of time before it lost its monopoly on operating systems. Along the way, Netscape invented many of the foundational technologies of the modern Internet, including JavaScript, SSL, and cookies. Once inside AOL, I was assigned to run the e-commerce platform, and Mark became the chief technology officer. After a few months, it became apparent to both of us that AOL saw itself as more of a media company than a technology company. Technology enabled great new media projects, but the strategy was a media strategy, and the top executive, Bob Pittman, was a genius media executive. Media companies focused on things like creating great stories, whereas technology companies focused on creating a better way of doing things. We began to think about new ideas and about forming a new company. In the process, we added 2 other potential co-founders to the discussion. Dr. Timothy Howes was co-inventor of the Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, LDAP, a masterful simplification of its Byzantine X.500 predecessor. We hired Tim at Netscape in 1996, and together we successfully made LDAP the Internet Directory Standard. To this day, if a program is interested in information about a person, it accesses that information via LDAP. The fourth member of our team was NC Cree, who had co-founded an application server company called Kiva Systems, which Netscape had acquired. He had been acting as CTO of the e-commerce division that I ran, and, in particular, worked closely with the partner companies in making sure that they could handle the AOL scale. As we discussed ideas, NSIC complained that every time we tried to connect an AOL partner on the AOL e-commerce platform, the partner's site would crash because it couldn't handle the traffic load. Deploying software to scale to millions of users was totally different from making it work for thousands, and it was extremely complicated. There ought to be a company that does all that for them. As we expanded the idea, we landed on the concept of a computing cloud. The term cloud had been used previously in the telecommunications industry to describe the smart cloud that handled all the complexity of routing, billing, and the like, so that one could plug a dumb device into the smart cloud and get all the smart functionality for free. We thought the same concept was needed in computing, so that software developers wouldn't have to worry about security, scaling, and disaster recovery. And if you're going to build a cloud, it should be big and loud. And that's how Loud Cloud was born. Interestingly, the most lasting remnant of Loud Cloud is the name itself, as the word cloud hadn't been previously used to describe a computing platform. We incorporated the company and set out to raise money. It was 1999. Chapter 2. I Will Survive. Did you think I'd crumble? Did you think I'd lay down and die? Oh no, not I. I Will Survive. Gloria Gaynor. I Will Survive. Coming off the success of Netscape, Mark knew all the top venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, so we needed no introductions. Unfortunately for us, Kleiner Perkins, the firm that backed Netscape, had already funded a potentially competitive company. We spoke to all the other top-tier firms and decided to go with Andy Ratcliffe of Benchmark Capital. If I had to describe Andy with one word, it would be gentleman. Smart, refined, and gracious, Andy was a brilliant abstract thinker who could encapsulate complex strategies into pithy sentences with ease. Benchmark would invest $15 million at a pre-money valuation, the value of the company before the cash goes into the company treasury, of $45 million. In addition, Mark would invest $6 million, bringing the total value of the company, including its cash, to $66 million, and would serve as our full-time chairman of the board. Tim Howes would be our chief technology officer. I would be CEO. Loud Cloud was 2 months old. The valuation and the size of the funding were signs of the times, and created an imperative to get big and capture the market before similarly well-funded competitors could. Andy said to me, "Ben, think about how you might run the business if capital were free." 2 months later, we would raise an additional $45 million from Morgan Stanley, in debt with no covenants and no payments for 3 years. So, Andy's question was more reality-based than you might think. Nonetheless, what would you do if capital were free is a dangerous question to ask an entrepreneur. It's kind of like asking a fat person, what would you do if ice cream had the exact same nutritional value as broccoli? The thinking this question leads to can be extremely dangerous. Naturally, I took the advice and ran with it. We quickly built out our cloud infrastructure and began signing up customers at a rapid rate. Within 7 months of founding, we'd already booked $10 million in contracts. Loud Cloud was taking off, but we were in a race against time and the competition. This meant hiring the best people and fielding the broadest cloud service, and that meant spending money. Lots of it. Our ninth hire was a recruiter, and we hired a human resources person when we had a dozen employees. We were hiring 30 employees a month and snagging many of the valley's smartest people. One of our new recruits had quit his job at AOL to spend 2 months mountain climbing, but instead, he joined us. Another forfeited millions to join Loud Cloud when he resigned from another company on the day of its IPO. 6 months in, we had nearly 200 employees. Silicon Valley was on fire, and LoudCloud was billed in a Wired cover story as Marc Andreessen's second coming. We traded our first office, where you'd blow a circuit if you ran the microwave and coffee maker at the same time, for a 15,000-square-foot warehouse in Sunnyvale, which was too small for us by the time we moved in. We spent $5 million to move into a new three-story stucco building with jade-colored tiles we called the Taj, as in the Taj Mahal. It was also too small to keep pace with our hiring frenzy, and people were sitting in the hallways. We rented a third parking lot down the street and ran shuttle vans to the office. The neighbors hated us. The kitchen was stocked like Costco, and when we fired the snack contractor for making our fridge look like the one in Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus, he asked for equity. This was the time. In the next quarter, we booked $27 million worth of new contracts, and we were less than 9 months old. It seemed like we were building the greatest business of all time. Then came the great dot-com crash. The NASDAQ peaked at 5,048.62 on March 10, 2000, more than double its value from the year before, and then fell by 10% 10 days later. A Barron's cover story titled Burning Up predicted what was to come. By April, after the government declared Microsoft a monopoly, the index plummeted even further. Startups lost massive value, investors lost massive wealth, and dot-coms, once heralded as the harbinger of a new economy, went out of business almost overnight and became known as dot-bombs. The NASDAQ eventually fell below 1,200, an 80% drop from its peak. We thought our business might have been the fastest growing of all time at that point. That was the good news. The bad news was that we needed to raise even more money in this disastrous climate. Nearly all of the $66 million in equity and debt we'd raised had already been deployed in our quest to build the number one cloud service and to support our now fast-growing set of customers. The dot-com crash had spooked investors, so raising money wasn't going to be easy, especially since most of our customers were dot-com startups. This became quite clear when we pitched the deal to the Japanese firm SoftBank Capital. My friend and LoudCloud board member, Bill Campbell, knew the SoftBank people well and offered to get some back-channel information following the pitch. When my assistant told me that Bill was on the line, I quickly answered the phone. I was eager to hear where we stood. I asked, "Bill, what did they say?" Bill replied in his raspy coach's voice, "Ben, well, honestly, they thought you were smoking crack." With nearly 300 employees and very little cash left, I felt like I was going to die. It was the first time I'd felt that way as CEO of LoudCloud, but not nearly the last. During this time, I learned the most important rule of raising money privately. Look for a market of one. You only need one investor to say yes, so it's best to ignore the other 30 who say no. We eventually found investors for a Series C round, meaning our third round of funding, at an amazing $700 million pre-money valuation, and raised $120 million. The sales forecast for the quarter came at $100 million, and things seemed like they might be okay. I felt confident that our sales forecasts would hold up, given that previous forecasts had underestimated actual performance, and perhaps, I speculated, we could seamlessly migrate our customer base away from dot-com bombs to more stable traditional customers, such as Nike, our largest customer at the time. And then the wheels came off. We finished the third quarter of 2000 with $37 million in bookings, not the $100 million that we'd forecast. The dot-com implosion turned out to be far more catastrophic than we'd predicted. Euphoria and terror. I needed to raise money yet again. Only this time, the environment was even worse. In the fourth quarter of 2000, I met with every possible funding source, including Prince Al-Walid bin Talal of Saudi Arabia, but nobody was willing to invest money at any valuation. We'd gone from being the hottest startup in Silicon Valley to unfundable in 6 months. With 477 employees and a business that resembled a ticking time bomb, I searched for answers. Thinking about what might happen if we ran completely out of money, laying off all the employees that I'd so carefully selected and hired, losing all my investors' money, jeopardizing all the customers who trusted us with their business, made it difficult to concentrate on the possibilities. Mark Andreessen attempted to cheer me up with a not-so-funny-at-the-time joke. Mark: do you know the best thing about startups? Ben: what? Mark: you only ever experience two emotions, euphoria and terror. And I find that lack of sleep enhances them both. With the clock ticking, one unattractive but intriguing option emerged. We could go public. In an oddity of the times, the private funding market shut down for companies with our profile, but the window on the public market remained just slightly open. This may sound like a crazy anomaly, and it was, but private funds had become completely cynical, while the public markets were only 80% of the way there. With no other options available, I needed to propose to the board that we go public. In order to prepare, I made a list of the pros and cons of an IPO. I knew that Bill Campbell would be the critical person I'd need to persuade one way or another. Bill was the only one of our board members who had been a public company CEO. He knew the pros and cons better than anyone else. More important, everybody always seemed to defer to Bill in these kinds of sticky situations, because Bill had a special quality about him. At the time, Bill was in his 60s, with gray hair and a gruff voice, yet he had the energy of a 20-year-old. He began his career as a college football coach and did not enter the business world until he was 40. Despite the late start, Bill eventually became the chairman and CEO of Intuit. Following that, he became a legend in high tech, mentoring great CEOs such as Steve Jobs of Apple, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, and Eric Schmidt of Google. Bill is extremely smart, super charismatic, and elite operationally. But the key to his success goes beyond those attributes. In any situation, whether it's the board of Apple, where he served for over a decade, the Columbia University Board of Trustees, where he is chairman, or the girls' football team that he coaches, Bill is inevitably everybody's favorite person. People offer many complex reasons for why Bill rates so highly. In my experience, it's pretty simple. No matter who you are, you need two kinds of friends in your life. The first kind is one you can call when something good happens, and you need someone who will be excited for you. Not a fake excitement veiling envy, but a real excitement. You need someone who will actually be more excited for you than he would be if it had happened to him. The second kind of friend is somebody you can call when things go horribly wrong, when your life is on the line and you only have one phone call. Who's it going to be? Bill Campbell is both of those friends. I presented my thinking as follows. We've not been able to find any investors in the private markets. Our choices are to either keep working on private funding or start preparing to go public. While our prospects for raising money privately seem quite difficult, going public has a large number of issues. Our sales processes are not robust, and it's difficult to forecast in any environment. We're not in any environment. We are in a rapidly declining environment, and it's not clear where the bottom is. Our customers are going bankrupt at an alarming and unpredictable rate. We are losing money, and will be losing money for quite some time. We are not operationally sound. In general, we are not ready to be public. The board listened carefully. Their expressions showed deep concern with the issues I'd raised, and an awkwardly long silence ensued. As expected, Bill broke the dead air. "Ben, it's not the money." I felt a strange sense of relief. Maybe we didn't have to go public. Maybe I'd overestimated our cash problems. Perhaps there was another way. Then Bill spoke again. "It's the fucking money." "Okay. I guess we're going public." In addition to the issues I had outlined for the board, our business was complex and hard for investors to understand. We typically signed customers to 2-year contracts and then recognized the revenue monthly. This model is now common, but it was quite unusual then. Given the fast growth in our bookings, revenue lagged behind new bookings by quite a bit. As a result, our S-1, our registration with the SEC, stated that we had $1.94 million in trailing 6 months' revenue, and we forecast $75 million for the following year, an incredibly steep revenue ramp. Since earnings are driven by revenue and not bookings, we had gigantic losses. In addition, the stock option rules at the time made it seem like our losses were about four times as large as they actually were. These factors led to extremely negative press heading into the IPO. A scathing story in Red Herring, for instance, noted that our list of customers was quite thin and that we were too reliant on dot-coms. It quoted a Yankee Group analyst positing that we had lost something like $1 million per employee over the last 12 months and conjecturing that the way we did it was by having a bonfire in the parking lot and getting everyone busy burning dollar bills. Business Week took us apart in an article that declared us the IPO from hell. A Wall Street Journal cover piece quoted a money manager's reaction to our offering as, "Wow, they were desperate." One financier, who actually invested in the offering, called it the best option among a particularly ugly set of options. Despite the horrifying press, we prepared to hit the road. Benchmarking ourselves against comparable companies, we settled on the price of the offering at $10 per share after an upcoming reverse split, which would value the company at just under $700 million. Less than the valuation from the previous private round of financing, but much better than bankruptcy. It was not at all clear that we would be successful with the offering. The stock market was crashing, and the public market investors we visited were visibly distressed. At the end of the preparation process, and after the banks had signed off, our director of finance, Scott Cooper, received a call from our banker at Morgan Stanley. "Banker, Scott, did you know that $27.6 million of your cash is restricted and tied up in real estate commitments?" Scott: "Yes, of course." Banker: "So you have just over 3 weeks' worth of cash before you go bankrupt?" Scott: "Yes." Scott then relayed the conversation to me, saying, "Can you believe they underwrote the deal and didn't notice that the cash was restricted until now? We gave them all the documents." Right before we were to leave for the IPO roadshow, I called an all-company meeting to share two pieces of news. First, we were going public, or at least we were going to try to go public. Second, the company had fallen so far in value that we would have to reverse split the stock 2-for-1. I thought the first part would go okay, but I was worried about how the second piece of news would be received. We had to reverse split the stock to get the price per share high enough to go public. In theory, a reverse split shouldn't matter at all. Each employee owned a certain percentage of the company. The company had a total number of shares of stock. Multiply the total number of shares by the percentage, and you get the employee share number. Cut the number of shares in half, and, while employees would have half the number of shares, they'd still own the exact same percentage of the company. Nothing changed. Oh, but it did. As we grew from 0 to 600 employees in less than 18 months, the stage was set for hyperbole and momentum. Some overly excited managers oversold the dream. They spoke only in terms of shares, rather than in percentages, and spun stories of a potential $100 per share stock price. Employees then calculated their fantasy price per share and figured out how much money they would make. I was aware that this was going on, but I never thought we would reverse split the stock, so I never worried about it. Like many other things that I screwed up during that period, I should have worried. My wife, Felicia, came to the all-company meeting as she always did. This time her parents were in town, so they came too. The meeting did not go well. People did not realize how close to the edge we were, so the news of the IPO didn't make anyone happy. The news of the reverse split made them even less happy. In fact, it infuriated them. I had literally cut their fantasy number in half, and they were not pleased about it. Nobody said harsh things directly to me. My in-laws, however, heard everything. And, as my father-in-law put it, it wasn't nothing nice. My mother-in-law, Loretta, asked my wife, "Why does everybody hate Ben so much?" Felicia, who was normally the most electric, outgoing person in any room, was just recovering from hernia surgery, so she wasn't her normal bubbly self. She was discouraged. My in-laws were depressed. The employees were pissed. I had no idea if I'd be able to raise the money. What a way to start a roadshow, an event that's usually the cause of a bit more fanfare. The roadshow was brutal. The stock market crashed daily, and technology stocks were to blame. Investors looked like they'd come out of torture chambers when we arrived. One mutual fund manager looked right at Mark and me and asked, "Why are you here? Do you have any idea what's going on in the world?" I thought that there was no way we'd be able to raise the money. We were going to go bankrupt for sure. I did not sleep more than 2 hours total during that entire 3-week trip. 3 days into the tour, I received a call from my father-in-law. John Wiley had been through a lot in his 71 years. As a boy, his father was murdered in Texas. In order to survive, he and his mother moved in with an unkind man and his 9 children. There John was abused, made to stay in the barn with the animals, while the other children ate his dinner. Eventually, John and his mother left that cruelty by walking for 3 days down a dirt road, carrying everything they owned. John would recall that journey in great detail his entire life. As a young man, before finishing his high school education, he left home to fight in the Korean War so that he could support his mother. As a young father of 5, he took every job imaginable to support his family, including unloading banana boats and working to build the Alaskan pipeline. He tragically saw 2 of his children die before he reached the age of 60. He had a hard life and was used to bad news. John Wiley did not call me for casual reasons. If he called, it was serious, possibly even deadly serious. "Ben, hello?" "John." "Ben, the office said not to bother you, but I just want to let you know that Felicia stopped breathing, but she's not going to die." "Ben, not going to die? What? What happened?" I could not believe it. I had been so focused on work that I had lost focus of the only thing that really mattered to me. Once again, I neglected to worry about the one thing that I should have worried about. "Ben, what happened?" "John, they gave us some medicine and she had an allergic reaction. She stopped breathing, but she's okay now." "Ben, when?" "John, yesterday." "Ben, what? Why didn't you tell me?" "John, I knew that you were busy and that you were really in trouble at work because of that meeting that I went to." "Ben, should I come home?" "John, oh no, we'll take care of her. You just take care of what you need to do." I was completely stunned. I started sweating so hard that I had to change my clothes right after the call. I had no idea what to do. If I returned home, the company would surely go bankrupt. If I stayed, how could I stay? I called back and had him put Felicia on the phone. "Ben, if you need me, I will come home." "Felicia, no, get the IPO done. There's no tomorrow for you in the company. I'll be fine." I stumbled through the rest of the roadshow, completely discombobulated. One day I wore a mismatching suit jacket and suit pants, which Mark pointed out to me midway through the meeting. I had no idea where I was half the time. During the 3 weeks we were on the road, comparable companies in our market lost half of their value, which meant that our $10 share price was roughly double the current benchmark. The bankers recommended that we lowered the price of the offering to $6 a share in order to reflect this new reality, but they gave us no assurance that the deal would actually get done. Then the day before the offering, Yahoo, the lighthouse company of the internet boom, announced Tim Kugel, its CEO, was stepping down. We had hit the nadir of the dot-com crash. The LoudCloud offering finally sold at $6 a share, and we raised $162.5 million. But there was no celebration and no party. Neither Goldman Sachs nor Morgan Stanley, the 2 banks that took us public, even offered us the traditional closing dinner. It may have been the least celebratory IPO in history. But Felicia was feeling better, and we had pulled it off. In a brief moment of lightheartedness on the plane ride home, I turned to Scott Cooper, my director of finance, and said, "We did it!" He replied, "Yeah, but we're still fucked." Years later, in 2012, after Yahoo fired its CEO, Scott Thompson, Felicia mused, "Should they bring back Kugel?" I replied, "Tim Kugel? How do you even know who Tim Kugel is?" She then relived the conversation we'd had 11 years earlier. It went something like this. Ben. We're fucked. Felicia. What do you mean? What happened? Ben. Yahoo fired Google. It's over. The whole thing is over. Felicia. Who is Google? Ben. He was the CEO of Yahoo. We're fucked.